And now, coming to you nearly live from deep within a mine shaft underneath Gold Hill, Nevada in Story County, it's the Storyteller Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Toll, and I'm here today to talk to you about a few things before we get into an interview with Patricia Ackerman. I had a chance to catch up with Patricia, who is running for the Nevada Assembly District 39, running against Jim Wheeler as a Democrat. Some people might think she's got a snowball's chance in Congress of actually making it to office, but there's been some really interesting things happening in the political landscape over the last couple of months. And in fact, people could trace this this idea or this phenomenon back to when Donald Trump was elected as president. The notion is that the status quo and the machine of politics, which has foisted upon us, same as it ever was, over and over again, business as usual, without much in the way of meaningful change to the average citizen, has been something that has been plaguing us for, you know, decades now. Both here in Story County with the ouster of Jack McGuffey, across the country, including the surprising upset of the socialist in New York City, I think she's in New York City, New York State for sure, where a 19-year incumbent was summarily shown the door. A good friend of mine, Theo McCormick, his daughter, Sarah Peters, won the Nevada district in Reno. There were no Republican opponents, and the Democratic establishment told her, hey, you know, you're a 20-something young lady, and we've got a fella whose turn it is to run for this seat. You know, you can wait a couple of years and run, you know, when we tell you it's okay to run. And she basically said, hey, you know what, you guys can go pound sand. I'm running. If I lose, so be it. But she ended up crushing the fella who she was running against, which again was the anointed one from the Democratic Party machine. So there's a notion that across the country, here in the state of Nevada and here locally, that folks are getting pretty tired of the status quo. I think it's fair to say that that Mr. Wheeler represents the status quo. He's held the District 39 for some time, and he, you know, is the minority, speaker or whip. I'm not sure what the proper term is here for the assembly in Nevada. And, you know, Patricia Ackerman, Trish, as she likes to be called, is giving him a serious run for his money and is proving to be a serious candidate, a sober, intelligent candidate. And we've had a chance, as I mentioned, to catch up with her. And I'd like to play for you that interview with her. I've met with her a couple of times. I've talked to her. We certainly do not agree on everything. In fact, there are quite a few things that we don't agree upon. But one thing that she does represent is a breath of fresh air. She represents, again, a clear choice from Mr. Wheeler. And some of her ideas are you know, miles away from where Mr. Wheeler sits. So for those of you who are interested, continue on with the conversation. Even if you aren't interested, I encourage you to listen, because our conversation did cover a number of different topics, healthcare, education, the economy. It's as she says, the three legs of the stool are jobs, healthcare, and education. And so we had a chance to dive into those subjects, her feelings on them deeply. And I hope you do listen. It's a great conversation, and we'll catch you at the end of the conversation. Without any further ado, Patricia Ackerman.
Helping to improve people's lives because of this bickering and this divisiveness between the parties. So people are responding very positively to me speaking about, you've got to take off your blue t-shirts, you've got to take off your red t-shirts, this ain't a football game. These are people's lives, and this is where we have to focus on. So because of that, people on both sides of all spectrums of political inclinations are leaning toward a person who wants to be the bridge builder and also has a few brain cells that work pretty well and a lot of compassion. So it's resonating very well with the people, and that makes the campaigning a lot of fun and very positive for me.
You know, I like to remind people that, you know, regardless of what t-shirt you wear, we're Americans first, and we need to return to a place, I think, before much of the mainstream media used the tactics to, you know, divide us and to delineate us and to paint us into one size or another. You know, it's frustrating sometimes to realize that we have a lot more in common than the things that potentially separate us. And so I think it's important to focus on that and to make sure that we remember we're Americans first.
Yes, absolutely. And I agree with you. And yes, you really hit a very important point. And when I do reach out to people who, for example, I was at the Douglas Sheriff's Station about 4 days ago. We went there to listen to a friend's hearing. And afterwards, Todd had to do some business up in the front as far as getting a license for an event that we have coming up. So I was chatting with a couple of the security guards who were retired police officers in the front. And we chatted for about 20 minutes. And it was very sweet when one of the elder gentlemen just spoke up and said, you know, you're such a lovely, lovely lady. Because I was giving them all my background, the things that I've done, and, you know, that I was also with Long Beach Mounted Police. So there was a camaraderie-ness that we had between one another. And then the one gentleman asked me, what do you do now? And I had my notebook that has my campaign logo on it, and I pushed it in front of him, and I says, well, actually, this is what I'm doing right now. When the two gentlemen realized that I was running for office, then the other gentleman says, well, okay, so what party are you? And I said, okay, sir, this is a part that I know you're not going to like. Oh, no, they said, you're a Democrat? And we all started to laugh about it. And then our conversation shifted to politics from all of the other things that we were delightfully talking about sports and a lot of other things. And there was a subtle shift between these two fellas who realized that I now had a label on me that didn't exist just 20 minutes before. But they couldn't deny that we are so much alike. Our values are very, very similar. We just have a little different way of going to the end result most of the time. And I'm seeing that more and more, that people do. When we look at each other eye to eye, heart to heart, we do see that we are far more alike than we are different. And it's just a matter of opening conversations, listening, letting the dialogue flow, respecting others' opinions in the process. And we do ultimately come to find that, yeah, we are just one big tribe. We're all one big family.
It's interesting that you describe the reaction that you got from those folks when you revealed that you're a Democrat. The district, you know, District 39 has been held by Mr. Jim Wheeler for some time. He is clearly a nice conservative Republican, and he's, you know, got a pretty strong hold on what would most folks would consider to be a fairly conservative district. I was intrigued to learn that, unlike my perception, Story County is well represented in the Democratic Party. I thought there were like three or maybe four Democrats here registered in Story County, but there's over 700 and I think 730 and change registered Democrats. And so one of the things that I think is really interesting, a young woman, Alejandra Ocasio-Cortez in New York, has just upset a, you know, 19-year entrenched Democrat, a person who is entrenched in the party and an incumbent that nobody thought would lose to her, and she just emerged triumphant from her primary. So I think that you know, you can, that we as voters can take from the starting with President Trump and being carried through with a number of different elections across the country, we can see that there is a dissatisfaction with the status quo and with folks who've been in place for a very long time. Are you finding any encouragement from these things?
Oh, of course, yes, because it's, you know, Alejandra is one of a number, as you're well aware of, seats that were very, very conservative that ultimately landed with a young Democrat or even someone from the LGBTQ community. So, yes, this is very encouraging to see that people are really not satisfied or happy with the direction, the uninclusivity, if that's such a word, that this particular administration has helped to unleash. And I think generally humanity will prevail, compassion will prevail, inclusivity will prevail, even though there's no denying that we do have more racism in our country than what most people would like to admit, and we have to own that, and we have to recognize that, and then we have to move forward to try and change that. I think over the last the 8 years that we had President Obama, I think there was a civility that was for the most part capping the kind of rhetoric and the kind of divisive discourse that is now being unleashed. And I quite frankly, I blame that on our current president. So it is really encouraging to see that the majority of the people in these particularly red districts are saying, no, in my gut, in my heart, this isn't right. And they're doing the right things.
So we've talked a little bit about 30,000-foot view things as the country is going, but let's talk a little bit about you specifically. What do you stand for? Why are you running?
I stand for... Well, there's a difference between what I think, the way that I semantically see it, is there's a little difference between what I stand for and what a platform is. What we know is what is this particular candidate running on. And what I stand for is equality, is equity between humans. I stand for being firm with human rights. I stand for supporting working families rather than moneyed corporations. So those are kind of my core values. What my platform is and the things that I want to focus on once I get into the legislature are the things that I've been hearing from the now hundreds and hundreds of people that I've been talking to over all these many months that I've been reaching out and, as you call it, campaigning. And the number one fear across the board, regardless of what your political inclination is, where you live, or even how much money, unless you are really in the upper echelons of an income, is health care. People are scared. You know, they've expressed that, you know, the costs, the lack of accessibility of health care is frightening. And, you know, we all know that the healthcare industry and our pharmaceutical industry is responsible for this very, very broken system that's profit-driven, and it doesn't really deserve to be called healthcare anymore. I mean, it literally is frequently reduced to it's either your money or your life with today's healthcare costs. So that is my primary focus, and I know that I would be very, very good at what steps we can take within the legislature to help rein this in. Things like, I don't know if our listeners will be familiar with what's called bundled pricing for procedures. Basically, it's like this. It's, you know, if anybody's ever gone to a hospital visit and they've tried to decipher their bill afterwards, and they all of a sudden look at their bill and there's $30 for a sleeping pill, you know, or a specialist all of a sudden visited your bedside that you don't even remember or even needed. You know, there's a lot of us who have experienced that. So if we can produce what's called bundled pricing for procedures, we can get rid of those billing shocks that that we're hit with right now. That's one tactic within legislature that we can do. I think that pharmacists ought to have more prescribing power than what they have. That would also help within the rurals where a lot of individuals don't have access to going to medical facilities, or it's too far, or they don't have transportation, et cetera. We can also make it legal to import drugs from Canada, where they are a whole lot cheaper. They're like about, they're probably about a quarter the price of what we have here. And Vermont, for example, is the very first state in the U.S. to actually do so. They did this in early 2018 this year because the Canadian prices are so low. So it's time for us to fight back. There's no reason why the state of Nevada can't follow suit with that.
You know, it's interesting that you touch on that. Two things that I got from that. One is it's important not to confuse coverage with care. Simply because you can afford or can barely afford to pay an insurance premium doesn't necessarily guarantee that will equate into care that you need at the point of impact. And,
Absolutely.
You know, a lot of folks struggle with their copays. They struggle with the premiums for their prescriptions. And I, of course, differ from Democrats. I'm actually a registered libertarian, and I believe strongly in the free market. You talked about, you know, big pharma and insurance companies, you know, having a game on the system. And you're absolutely right. They do so at the expense of the free market. And your suggestion of opening the ability for Americans to buy prescriptions on the free market is absolutely right. It, you know, there's no reason that we should be excluded from the benefits of Canadian prescriptions simply because we live on the other side of the border. Let's look at solutions that can work. Let's look at what the problem is and what's forcing or preventing us from driving those prices down and preventing profiteering from happening, and that'll help everyone.
Right, right. We should be able to shop for health care and know exactly what the prices are going to be, not what the hospitals decide to charge us. And this is what's happening with our system right now. So there's legislation that can be introduced that can make the buying and the understanding a lot simpler. I mean, can you imagine going into any sort of store and all of a sudden the store just determines what the price is based on something similar to the situation that we have with insurance, based on what kind of coverage or maybe what kind of income we have? They determine what they're going to be charging us. These are the kind of things that absolutely have to be reined in. So, you know, some of the other things that we can do is like the prescription prices, device prices. Across the U.S., we have a lot of devices that are being utilized within the human bodies now. I personally have two prosthetic hips from doing a lot of climbing. And the device prices are so skyrocketed. They're charging something in the neighborhood of $22,000 to $35,000 just for the device. For metal, this is insane, and we can simply declare that we're not going to pay any more than what Canada is doing with the same devices. You can get a prosthetic hip from Canada for about $2,500. So
yeah,
these are the kind of.
You know, that's really amazing. I was in Tokyo a few years back, and I remember walking down the street and seeing what was in essence, it looked like a coffee shop, but it was really an MRI shop. And, you know, you could go in, have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea, get an MRI on your knee or your hip or whatever you needed. And the price, I had just had an MRI done stateside, and the price was about a quarter of what I paid earlier. And in talking to the proprietor, you know, he pointed at the machine. He said, you know, you were probably examined by this machine from Siemens. They make most of them. And here
yeah.
in Japan, I can buy this machine for about a quarter of what it costs in the United States. That's why I can offer it for a couple hundred bucks, and you're on your way in a few minutes. It's just amazing what we have allowed to happen in our healthcare system without having much of a choice or a say, and folks, you know, making a ton of money on our misfortune.
Yes, yeah, I agree with you there. So even if this was just the only issue that I were to tackle once getting into the legislature, I mean, this would be a full-time job as it is, because there's just so much, and it would be a worthwhile endeavor to focus and just solely on healthcare. But you know, I think you may have heard the analogy that I use when we first met, that I see our societies are very delicately balanced societies standing on a three-legged stool. And if you visualize that three-legged stool, you know that if any one of those three legs is broken, that stool comes crashing down. And that's the way that I see society. And those three legs of society consist of healthcare, education, and jobs or employment. So if any one of those is not functioning, that stool goes down, and we've got two very, very broken legs in the state of Nevada and in the rurals, especially because we have very minimal access to health care in the rurals, and it's a major crisis. So I personally believe that every legislator, every elected official really ought to be focusing on all of those three legs to be a really viable elected official. It's a lot of work, and you know, to do your job right, you ought to be, but it's a challenge. But that's what I want to focus on, is those three legs, and those are my primary focuses once I get into the legislation. So if you want to segue into one of those, go.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In fact, here in Story County, I am running for school board.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I feel very passionately about our educational system, the direction that it, has in the influence in the in what it how it can forge the future of our country. And I pushed three kids through high school. My youngest daughter graduated last year. And there's a lot of things, obviously Nevada is fighting for last place between a couple of states. And regardless of how much money we seem to throw at the problem, it keeps getting worse. One of my observations as a parent is that, and this was really an evolutionary process for me, I simply assumed that the folks at the school district had things handled, and that their focus and the direction that they had was the one to believe in, and let them do their job without much of input. I woke up sadly at the end of my kid's educational career and became involved actively. For those who don't know, I'm a Nevada native, but I left for a 30-year career in California in South Placer County outside of Sacramento. And my kids went through the California educational system. And one of the biggest things that I took from it was that my kids all took, algebra, trigonometry. My son took calculus. All of them graduated without the remotest clue of how to balance a checkbook, of how credit cards are, work and can be very dangerous, about the realities of, student loans, how easy the money is to spend, how impossible it is to repay. And, in essence, they came out of high school financially illiterate. And so that's a big thing for me. I'm part of my platform is that I want to improve on those things. But tell the listeners a little bit about your ideas and thoughts on education.
Sure. Okay. Well, I live within a family of dedicated public school teachers. My husband recently retired from Carson High School after 30 years of teaching math. His father, mother, brother, and sister were all public school teachers, and I'm also a certified teacher in Vedic sciences. So it's a passion within our family for passing on knowledge, because we all know that knowledge is power. When it comes to our educational system, I think there's a, for many people, there's a disconnect of how critical what our day-to-day lives are like. The minute we step out of our doors, literally the minute we open our eyes in the morning, every morning, our lives are improved by the skills of our communities that are formed and developed by our schools, from plumbers to car mechanics to computer tech that's down the street. I mean, we all experience the results of our public schools in every walk of life, and we benefit from it. So if our public schools don't produce really vibrant, well-educated graduates, our societies are going to begin to fall. And in our own district, I mean, we're all seeing this big boom in the tech industry, you know, like Tesla and Switch is coming here due to this very favorable tax exemption that Nevada's given them. So we got to make certain that our graduates can land those coveted high-paying jobs by supplying that high-quality education. So that's kind of like my blanket belief is when it comes to our school systems.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As a Carson High graduate, my hats are off to your freshly retired husband. go Senators. I couldn't agree more with you when you say that, you know, we need to prepare our kids for careers that exist in the world today. So many of the kids, you know, focus on college, which is great and important. I think that we need to return our focus a little bit on vocational, hands-on careers for kids who may make more sense. But, you know, to educate, you know, to go through college, get $100,000 in college debt, and walk out with a degree in 16th century Irish poetry, doesn't serve anyone well, and the future of our country depends on us preparing and producing kids, young adults, Americans who are capable of earning a solid wage, and helping us all succeed as a country.
Yes. Right after my husband retired, when I decided that I was going to start running for the state assembly, we realized that I was going to have to pull away from my part-time job. So Todd decided to take a contract position back at Carson High School, where he was one of the CTE staff, the career and technical training. And this, I think, is one of the missing links and what we need to focus a lot more on, which is in keeping with what you were just saying a little bit ago, that if we focus less on, you know, the teaching to the test and the academics and start preparing these young individuals for life through technical and career training and teaching them the nuts and bolts of what life would be like getting out of high school and going directly into a job. And the schools are starting to recognize this. So the career and technical training programs are starting to get a lot more funding. There's a lot more interest into it. Parents are getting a lot more interested, and so are the kids. So I think that this is an aspect of our public schools that need to go with the times. We are going through a change in a shift within our societies. The technical world is going to continue to boom, but we also need to start training people to work those regular jobs that has not been focused on so much in the past. So I think that's an important aspect of improving our public schools. And there's a number of bullet points also that I feel pretty strongly about when it comes to how we can help to heal up those fissures and those cracks where we're losing money within the school systems. And I think we need to start with the school funding formula. I was talking with Chris Giunchigliani, when it comes to qualification, when it comes to schools, she's been there. She spent her entire career in school, so she and I have been bouncing things around, and she's been showing me where the funding formula is not working. So these are things that within the legislature we all have to get together and have to work on. It's not going to be easy, obviously. Even people who have been in this for a long, long time are looking and scratching their heads going, wow. But the reality is that it has to. There's a tremendous amount of focus that has to be there. Class sizes, for example, are so large and so overburdened that the children just aren't going to get a good education with that type of a class. So they have to be reduced, and we have to set that standard within the legislature. One of the other things that a lot of people also don't think about when it comes to our public schools is the mental health crisis that we have. I don't know if you're aware, Sam, that in the state of Nevada, we are, once again, dead last nationally when it comes to mental health funding. So one of the things that's been bounced around and is starting to gain a lot of steam is that we can start implementing mental health crisis teams within our schools to have highly trained mental health therapists available to catch those kids who would otherwise fall through the cracks of society that ultimately are going to pay cost society through drug abuse, gangs, gun violence, domestic violence, you know, the high rates of depression that we have right now and suicide. So we have to look at the fact that our society is different right now. We've got different stresses than we've ever had before. We've got a high rate of drug abuse, the opioid crisis included. So by implementing a mental health therapist within the schools and having that mandated, we can start catching those kids that ultimately cost society a whole lot more than what that mental health therapist would cost by putting them into the schools. So there's a huge list of bullet points that anybody who's interested in following some of my other ideas rather than going into it, because we could probably continue this conversation, Sam, for the next 2 hours.
I know I could, yeah.
Details, yeah. Anybody who's interested in that, they can get onto my website, which we're, by the way, in the process of improving, because the old website is pretty antiquated and simple. So we're just about ready to launch the new website that has all the details as far as the things that I stand for, and people can learn a lot more about where I stand on all the different issues.
Good for you. So for those listeners who are interested, Ackerman 4, the number 4, Assembly, Ackerman 4, Assembly.com is where people can find you. Is that right?
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
Great. Yeah, you're right. We could talk, and I could certainly talk on and on about education. Let's talk about, however, let's move to the third leg of your stool regarding jobs. Obviously, you know, Nevada is right now enjoying its lowest unemployment rate in years and years. Governor Sandoval has taken a lot of credit for that. The Governor's Office of Economic Development, I make a point of going to their meetings and talking to the folks about where places like Reno and Vegas, things seem to be off the hook. But if you go in the vast wasteland of Nevada, you will find that places like Lovelock, places like Battle Mountain, places like Eureka and Pioche, they're not faring as well, and there's very little attention being paid to the rurals. I've told the governor that, you know, the scraps that fall off the table at TRI and at the Raider Stadium could feed rural Nevada for years, and yet, you know, very little attention is being paid to them. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I totally agree with you there, too. I've got my sights set on where we can make the most significant improvements in our lives, and that's small and that's local. You know, the reason that we came here, Sam, is we live in this amazingly rich Western history, the agriculture and all this beauty. And we can nurture economic growth and development here and still protect our you know, this rural flavor that we have. So I have this vision for the locals, for the rurals. You know, imagine if, let's say, because I live in Minden here, imagine like Old Town Minden. I don't know if you've ever spent any time there, or even the rich heritage of Dayton or Silver City. So I imagine these places bustling with people who are drawn to locally owned businesses. I mean, restaurants serving healthy, locally grown foods, you know, from the abundant agriculture and the farm co-ops, friends hustling into town to share a coffee, a beer, you know, and smiles with neighbors that they run into. You know, a place where we can stroll sidewalks, enjoy sunsets, and basically protect those simple things in life. And yeah, that sounds like a very altruistic, lovely vision. And some people go, well, yeah, how are you going to make that happen? But we can. We can do that. I think that by focusing in on small businesses, making it very small business friendly, helping women and minority-owned businesses, support the workers, and I think that our local economies are going to flourish. And then also, you know, to touch on the, on a broad scale, we are also poised to create thousands of actually really terrific jobs in this blossoming clean, renewable energy sector, which is, you know, going to be a boom to our economy, and it's just waiting to happen. Will that affect the rurals? That remains to be seen. But what I want to see if we can focus on, and that also means we've got to light fires underneath our commissioners to see how we can create a vision to where we can start developing these rich bastions of history and flavor in these local rurals to their advantage. It's a tough haul, but it takes a lot of work to sit down and actually start hammering out a vision. And I haven't seen that vision being implemented, even in Douglas County. Like, for example, let's segue to affordable housing. I'm seeing these tracts of homes that are slated for development and some that have already been implemented. And I've got people calling me and telling me, what do you think about this? We can't stand this because it's basically scarring the land. It's creating what looks like, literally looks like low-income housing. And it's going to ruin the environment here as far as the aesthetics. So there are ways that we can create and develop a more robust economy in these rurals, but it takes a lot of strategic thinking rather than the way the, you know, the folks have been doing it in the past. So it's a lot of out-of-the-box thinking to help to develop the rurals in a way that will bring more abundance to them and have them flourish like a lot of the other areas of Nevada are economically.
You know, it's interesting. You touched on two things. One, you know, the affordable housing issue. It's really near crisis proportions here in northern Nevada, and actually all over Nevada. I read a report not long ago that ranks us near the bottom again. We're fighting for last place in the availability of affordable housing. You know, when you talk about, as a kid growing up here in Nevada, really there were two economies and they were pretty much tied together as one. Maybe there was a distant third in mining, but gaming and tourism were really, you know, what drove Nevada when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s and then 80s when I left. If you look around Nevada today, to your point of a diversification of the economy and the different types of ways that people are making a living and creating jobs and going about business, it's refreshing to see that. I'm concerned because that ecosystem is very fragile, and you know, all of us remember the events of 2007, 2008, 2009. Looking at the stock market, it's really only a matter of time before that bubble pops, and it's at that point that you know the economy is it becomes much more vulnerable, and it's much more of a challenge to make things work. You know, now when it's rocking and rolling, it's a different scene. So I'm very concerned about that, but I share your passion for and your desire for a diversity in the economy. You know, it's really funny. We've been chatting here now for nearly half an hour and it seems like we just got started. I'd like to give you a chance before we wrap up to, you know, to talk about anything that we may have overlooked that's important to you or that you want to touch on.
Let's see now if I can narrow it down, because there are so many. I think I will focus on the very last point is campaign finance reform. That's part of my platform. That's on my walk cards when I'm walking door to door. I want to get the dark, the big money out of politics. I want to end Citizens United, and I want to get that influence of that big money out of our elections, because it's undermining our democracy by increasing the power leverage by corporations and the very wealthy. And I think that it's become one of the most powerful destroyers of government, of the people, by the people, for the people. It's now into the corporation's hands, and I want to take our government back. So with my campaign, I am very proud to say that we have not taken one penny from a corporation or a special interest, and we're able to make this campaign do well. I think up to now we've raised approximately, from the very beginning, $22,000, which is a drop in the bucket relative to what even my opponent has raised. But I've looked at my opponent's list of donors, and there he has a tremendous number of corporations and casinos who have donated. The donations that we have of those $22,000 have come from grassroots. It's come from the neighbors. It's come from the communities. It's come from simple people and working people. And that's where I want to send a message to the state of Nevada, and I want to send a message to the rest of the nation. We can do campaigns on a smaller budget. We have to get the big money out of there because I want the people to take the government back. So I'd like to end it at that, and it's been resonating very, very well with people. They too feel the same way. They want their government back.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that the influence and the ability to hide, you know, contributions and obfuscate where that money comes from, as well as the sheer volume and amount that's available, is really almost a corrupting, well, not almost, a corrupting influence on the entire process. I'll share with you two thoughts of mine that I have on that, and maybe you can consider these as new bills that you'd introduce as a freshman on the assembly. And that would be to limit the campaigning season, so to speak, to 60 days prior to the election date. You know, that would certainly close the window on the amount of money that could be spent. But the other thing really to consider, I think, and perhaps you'll agree with me, is that if we have, you know, a single source of funding that comes, that's available to everyone, and it's capped at whatever is, you know, that we can all agree on is a, quote, reasonable amount. You know, for most of our folks in Washington, you know, 70% of their day is spent raising funds, collecting money for donors, and they're not working for us when they do that.
Exactly. That's right.
Right.
That's right.
So great. Well, listen, Patricia, it's just really been a pleasure talking with you. I'm going to invite you to come back on in another, you know, 6 weeks or so that we can talk a little bit more about how your campaign's going and how things are treating you out there in the streets. I wish you the very best, and am excited that you know, that folks in Story County, in Lyon County, in Douglas, and also in Carson City County, right? Are you still, is 39 still part of Carson City as well?
Carson is a separate district.
It is. Okay. So you skirt Carson, but certainly Story County and Lyon County fall into your reign. I'm glad that that folks here have a choice, and I look forward to talking to you again in the near future. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Sam. It has been an absolute pleasure once again. And just real quick, those two propositions as far as legislation, I'm 100% behind you. Thank you for fleshing that out.
Great. Yeah.
I agree with you.
Thank you. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but if people want to get a hold of you, is it okay to give out the cell number? I guess it's on your card, so it's okay to give that.
It is.
So, folks, I encourage you to call Patricia 775-721-1910. Again, the web address is Ackerman for Assembly, and that's the number 4, AckermanForAssembly.com. And you can email her at AckermanForAssembly@gmail.com. Did I get that right?
You got it right. Thank you, Sam.
Excellent, excellent. Well, thanks again. And as I said, I look forward to speaking with you again shortly.
I do too. A pleasure, always. Thank you.